This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Pete Townsend, co-founded The Who and was its guitarist and main songwriter. The group was founded in 1964 in London and soon became a voice of teenage rebellion with anthems like Townsend's song My Generation. This song has his most famous line, "Hope I die before I get old."
People try to put us to death.
Generation.
Just because we get around.
Talking about my generation.
Things they do look awful.
Talking cold. About my generation.
I hope I die before I get old.
Talking about my generation.
Townsend's rebellious energy was expressed not only in his songs, but in his power chords and in the way he'd smash his guitar at the end of his concerts. Even people who don't know much about The Who are aware of their rock opera Tommy, about the deaf, dumb, and blind kid who became a pinball wizard. The 1969 album was later adapted into a film by Ken Russell, and now it's a Broadway hit. There's even a new Tommy coffee table book that Townsend has contributed to. Before Townsend decided to take Tommy to Broadway, he broke his wrist in a bicycle accident, which left him temporarily unable to play.
The wrist injury was a life-changing thing for me. It changed a whole lot of things, and because it was so in the short term, immediately after the accident, it was so devastating. I couldn't write, I couldn't type, I certainly couldn't play any musical instrument, and it was a very, very complicated fracture, and. And I had no idea whether physiotherapy was going to get what kind of movement I was going to get back, and all the signs were that it was going to be a long, drawn out process of maybe 5 years with maybe three or four operations, and so I was kind of looking at, you know, and I suppose in a way I was already in semi retirement. I had a career as a solo artist, but you know, I didn't, you know, it's not something that takes up an immense amount of time, and I just had time to stop and look at what was happening in my life and who I was and who I wanted to be and you know, how much I really cared about not being able to play and how much I really cared about not being able to write and that kind of thing, and around that time, Pace Theatrical of Houston rang me and set up a meeting with Des Makinoff.
The director of...
That's right,
Tommy.
Yeah. And I think, because I had space in my life, but also, I suppose, a void in my life at the time, you know, a gulf stretching into the future, I actually felt... You know, it just felt fortuitous. You know, it felt like it was... a divine intervention.
So how much has your wrist healed?
It seems to be okay.
Can you play now?
Yeah, I've done a tour this year. I did a tour, a solo tour. I did about 15 shows, 10 to 15 shows, I can't remember. Maybe it was actually, a lucky 13, I think. And I had really good fun. I played everything that I wanted to play, and but I play slightly differently now, I think.
How so?
Because the actual flexibility of the wrist is reduced. Mm. I can't do those kind of flourishing, very, very fast flamenco-y things holding a plectrum, which is part of the kind of, not just the distinction of the way that I play, but also a vanity, you know, personal vanity. Nobody else that I know was ever able to do that. And now I can't do it either. So
when you hurt your arm and you say you asked yourself how much you cared about not being able to play, how much did you care?
I didn't care very much. I really didn't. I think it was really quite sobering in a way to realise that. I thought I was going to miss being able to sit around with a guitar and entertain myself. But I immediately started to learn to write longhand with my left hand. And by the time my right hand started to work, I was almost completely left-handed.
Hmm.
Take something away from somebody and it makes you revalue everything else that you've got. And I think that's what I did. So no, I'm not trying to be callous or hard or indifferent to my... talent. But that was the space I was in. I was kind of in a space where I wasn't really worrying so much about what I'd lost, but I was very interested in what I'd gained. And I had a very clear list of things to do, 100 things to do, you know, while you can't play the guitar. And one of the things at the very, very bottom of the list, and I managed to actually get through this list in about a week. One of the things at the bottom of the list was go and see Mum, my mother, and ask her about the lost years.
The lost years?
The lost years.
The years when you were with your grandparents?
Yeah.
Well, it was your parents were on the road, I think. Your father was a musician.
Yeah.
And well, you spent, when you were about 5 to 7, you were with your grandparents.
That's right. Not with my grandparents. I was with my grandmother, who was a single woman. Mm-hmm. She actually deserted my mother when she was married.
Why was it so important to you to feel? What did you need to know about that?
Well,
time?
I couldn't remember. I couldn't remember anything, and I couldn't remember very much about those years. All I could remember was really quite unpleasant things, and I wanted to know. So I went to see my mother, and I said, "Listen, don't give me any details. Don't give me any stuff. Don't give me any emotion. Just give me facts. I want to know where I was on, you know, June 1st, where I was on June 2nd, and because I said, you know, let me. Digest that, and then I'll come back later and ask you about the emotional stuff, the personal stuff, and the reasons. And whenever she did, I ran a tape machine, and whenever she digressed, I got her back on track and said, "No, listen, just stick to the facts and help me, because you know." And she's been preparing material about her own life. She's trying to write a book about her own life, and so a lot of the stuff was fairly fresh in her mind, but.
So did this, were there revelations for you in what she told you?
Yeah. I mean, shocking revelations.
Like what? I don't know if you'd care to share them or not.
I can't really share them.
That's fine.
But what I realized was is that some of the memories that I did have of my childhood, that stopped, you know, where you know, you kind of go into a dark tunnel and you can't see what's at the other end of a memory. I'd actually remembered them in my work, that my writing was the memory that still functioned. You know, I've even been in therapy and, you know, confronted or come to that point where I've actually tried to, you know, remember that stuff. And my therapist once said to me, I'm not in therapy anymore, I did it for 3 years. Write it down, you know, write it down. Write down what happened. And when you come to the point that you can't remember, just keep writing. And when I sat down to start writing, I started to get this incredible feeling of dread. And it was so enormous that I just broke down. And I realized that if I continued to try to remember, I would actually have a kind of nervous breakdown, and decided not to go on. You know, and I don't think, and what's interesting is just so that people don't think this is the Oprah Winfrey show. the reason why I can't talk about what happened is that I don't think it's particularly significant. In comparison to the terrible, terrible things that have happened to people that I know and the people that I read about. But its effect on me was enormous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't mean to suggest deep, dark secrets necessarily.
Right.
A curious kind of, you know, definitely a curious byproduct of being the child of not only two very young people who were born in the war, met in the war and married in the Air Force. And, you know, my father was very glamorous, wonderful looking, looked like a film star. My mother was a very sexy, well-dressed, young girl, and you know, that I think, you know, I came along very, very quickly. I think my mother, you know, conceived me like within about a week of their marriage, and there I was, you know. And I think, you know, he was out on the road still young, having fun, and my mother had been a singer in a band, and I think she just wanted some time to herself, so she hung with me for about 2.5-3 years, and they were such fantastic years. You know, I was out on the road with my mum and dad, and I was with them all the time. And I,
yeah,
you know, I used to sleep in between them. You know, I was in the way. I was there. I was the, you know, I was the star of the show. I was on the stage. I can remember show business. And then it just goes black.
Well, how did show business look to you when you were young and your parents were on the road? Was that the kind of life you thought you might want for yourself sometime?
Oh, there was no question. That was what I was going to do.
That's what you wanted?
Yeah, no, I it wasn't what I wanted. It's what I had. It was where I was. It's like, you know, this is Liza Minnelli and Lorna Luft, you know, except that for me, it was both mum and dad there all the time. And this extended family, it's a big dance orchestra, you know, with like 26 members.
But your father played clarinet?
Clarinet and saxophone, yeah.
And your mother sang?
Yeah, yeah.
No, before rock, and before you seriously took up guitar, you liked trad jazz, and I think you even played banjo before you got serious about the guitar. What did you prefer about jazz during the period that you were into that and didn't listen to that much rock?
Oh, this is a neat conjunction. It was the fact that it connected more with my father and the kind of music that he played. The band used to play a Dixieland set in the show, which was very popular when I was a teenager. This is my father's band.
Mm-hmm.
It was a concession to the young people, you know, the crazy young people who like that jazz stuff, because most of it was ballroom dancing.
Uh-huh.
So this was a sort of 20-minute set, and my father played lead clarinet, and I used to love that because this seemed to me to be, you know, where, this was pre my discovery of rock and roll. And had I been exposed, you know, to, I don't know, John Lee Hooker or Hank Williams or any of those kind of early, or even Pete Seeger or any of those people that were kind of defining how the song was going to become a rock song, and, you know, how the song of those three different distinct forms of popular music would come together as the rock song 10 years later. If I'd have heard that music, I don't know whether I would have responded to it at all. I had no context for it. So I think, you know, the trad jazz thing was just what, you know, it was something that grew out of my need to mm-hmm. do something that connected with my dad, who I worshipped.
Pete Townsend is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. We're back with Pete Townsend. You went to art school, though. Did you have artistic aspirations, in the visual arts?
Well, I'm actually quite good at painting and my visual eye is quite good. You know, I designed all the Who's early clothes and, you know, and posters and things like that, logos and I'm quite good in that area. But mm-hmm. actually before that, before I actually played the guitar, you know, from the ages of about, from 8 upwards to about 12, I wanted to be a journalist. And I think that actually informed the way that I think, probably more than being an artist. What going to art school did for me was not finish me off as an artist, because the course that I went to turned out to be a really crazy course. It actually turned me into a radical. It's the same course that David Bowie did. It's the same course that Brian Eno did. A deconstructionist kind of English Bauhaus course called the basic course, produced by a bunch of English artists who wanted to radicalize art school teaching.
Now, let me ask you about the beginnings of your music. Having come to rock and roll after being interested in jazz, after having played guitar, after having worshipped your father who played clarinet, when you started playing rock and roll, you really cranked up the volume and started using feedback and distortion, getting really far away from the sounds you were first interested in. Can you tell me why you became so interested in volume and distortion?
Well, there are a couple of different things. I mean, there's a sort of a sociologist in me on this subject, and I think and if I can actually talk about Jim Marshall as an example here, I won't talk about me. Let me talk about Jim Marshall. Jim Marshall's father was a boxer. Jim Marshall is the man who invented the Marshall amplifier, you know, the big stack that the Who used, that mm-hmm. Eric Clapton used, that Jimi Hendrix adopted when he came to the UK, that big wall of sound thing. And Jim had a music shop. And one day, I went in and we'd been playing at pubs. And I said, I've got these two American amplifiers, Jim. I've got a Fender Pro Amp and a Fender Bassman Amp. And I said, they're great amplifiers. They sound great. And I was already using a certain amount of feedback. And I said, but the trouble is that I can hear the audience. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, I can hear them. You know, I mean, if I'm playing and somebody's in the front row and they say, this is junk, I can hear what they're saying. I don't want to hear them, okay? And I said, so I need something bigger and louder. And his eyes lit up. And I said, can you do this for me? And he said, and he got his engineer out, and he said, do you think you can do this? And the guy said, yeah, I think I can do it. You know, I can do it. I could think I can do it. And I realised at that moment that what was actually happening was that I was demanding a more powerful machine gun. And Jim Marshall was going to build it for me. And then we were going to go out and blow people away all around the world. And the generation we were going to blow away was the generation immediately preceding us. The ones who had the gall to tell us that we were wimps because we had long hair, wimps because we didn't have wars to fight in, wimps because we couldn't prove ourselves in military service because we didn't have it, you know, it was not necessary anymore. We were post-atomic bomb people, that we were wimps, 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 and that the only reason that we even had electric guitars and rock and roll was because they'd paved the way for peace and given everything up, which is, of course, absolutely true, they had. You know, and Remembrance Day is a day that I take very seriously. It's just past. You know, I do remember those guys that gave us this peace. And I don't, you know, I cry for them. But I think that anger was something that really crossed over generations. It wasn't just from rock and roll. It just wasn't from me and my need to smash guitars. It was right over the whole industry, right through the whole of show business and rock and roll and the media and everybody. Everybody of that generation wanted it to be bigger, louder, and wanted it to be as big as the atomic bomb had been.
Now, how do you connect this to smashing guitars?
I think the connection isn't actually, you would call it in CD-ROM talk, you would call it a hyperlink. I don't think it's a direct connection. Mm-hmm. I think it was a byproduct of stage performance. I think, you know, that we that. You know, the first guitar that I broke in front of my grandmother. You know, when I was 14, it was.
Were you impressing her, or was this a mistake?
No. She came into. It was another take on the Jim Marshall story. She bought me my first guitar, which was a piece of trash.
Uh-huh.
And I was very upset because my father had recommended the guitar because I couldn't play the clarinet, and I wanted him to buy the guitar. So I was angry that she bought me this piece of trash. And it was very, very hard to play. And my dad said, well, you know, she has bought it for you. She is your grandmother. Try and learn to play something on it. And if you can, then I'll buy you a new one. And this went on and on and on and on. And one day I'm clunking away at this horrible kind of guitar, which was really fit only to be hung on the wall at an Italian restaurant next to the Chianti bottles. And I think that's where it probably came from. And she came in and she said, this is a bloody awful row, you know, why don't you play some proper music? And I said, listen, Nan, it's, we know what we're doing, you know, leave us alone. And I was with John Entwistle, who was, you know, we were little kids, really. And she said, no, turn it off, it's a bloody horrible row. So, and she said, if you don't turn it off, I'll smash it. So I said, no, you won't smash it. And I got the guitar, and I smashed it over the amplifier. I broke an amplifier at the same time too, a little kind of tiny amplifier, and she went completely white and walked out of the room. And John said, "You've done it now," and I said, "I might have." I said, "But John, I feel great." And of course, I was able then to go and look for a decent guitar and rob and steal to get it, which is what I did, and found myself a decent instrument. And from there on, I never looked back, really.
Yeah, but once you had a good instrument, why did you smash that on stage?
Guitars are very good for me to express myself by smashing them.
Mm-hmm.
They're very good for me to express myself by playing them. They're very good for express myself by pouring lighter fluid over them and warming my hands. You know, it depends what I'm doing. You know.
But let me ask you, how did the feeling you had the first time you smashed a guitar on stage compare to the feeling you had like the 100th time or the 200th time you'd done it? Did it still feel as good? Did it feel good in a different way?
I don't think it's ever felt good at all. I don't think it's something that I expected to feel good.
I mean, good in the sense of a release.
I don't think it's ever felt good as a sense of a release. I don't, you know, I'm afraid it's too, it's always been too, you know, I've always used the instrument that I happen to be playing at the time, and I mean, as I see it splinter, I'm thinking, oh my God, $1,000. But, you know, I've actually been enough of an artist and believed in the act enough to do it again and again and again.
Well, what does the act mean to you?
It means a number of things. I think it's a statement mainly of artistic independence. I mean, it's also an act of... It's in the same tone as, you know, as you know, we want our amplifiers to be loud so that we can't hear the response. It's like saying, okay, the show is over now. I am finished. And in a sense, that all music is over now. Everything to do with this particular event is over now. It's finished. You know, the interaction between me, you, and this guitar is over now. It's a big, dramatic action. And the reason that it has to, in a way, be theatrically violent, because I think that's as far as it gets. It's, you know, we used to smash our equipment up and then go back and drink, you know, cups of lemon tea. Like, I think that the reason that it needs to be theatrically violent is in a way that it is because the observation that the thing that we're trying, you know, get out of the you know to the response that we want from the audience is one of absolute reflection at that moment on everything that's happened up to that point, you know, to stun them, to actually stop them.
Well, I really wish we had more time to talk, but we have to wrap up. It's really been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
For being with us. Pete Townsend's rock opera Tommy is now a Broadway hit. There's also a new book called The Who's Tommy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.